like to do together is explore the act of consciousness itself that is the essence of prayer. And to do this with reference to representatives of the Kabbalistic tradition, Jewish mystical tradition, Jewish philosophical tradition, and with also some contemporary Jewish philosophic thought as well. I want to begin with a passage from the Talmud tractate Brachot, it's 33b, which recounts an incident. There should be a single sheet that goes around, if everyone has that sheet. The tractate Brachot recounts an incident in which a certain person was officiating as a leader of prayers in the presence of the great Tana Rabbi Hanina. And in the standard fixed liturgy, the daily prayers, the Amida prayer, as it's called, the Amida, is really the heart of the prayer service. And it begins with a series of three descriptive attributes that are addressed to God. God is praised as Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanora, God who is great, powerful, and awesome. That's the standard text. Now, this particular prayer leader decided that he was going to wax eloquent, and he began his prayer, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanora, Vahadir, Vahizuz, Vahayirui, Vahazak, Vahamitz, Vahavadai, Vahanechbad, he went on and on and on. God who is great, powerful, awesome, exalted, mighty, revered, strong, firm, glorious, on and on and on. So Rabbi Hanina waited until he finished. When he finished, he asked this particular prayer leader, he said, so, you've completed all the praises that are due to your Creator? What do you need all that for? You say the standard three attributes of praise, and were it not that Moses originally said them in the Torah, and that the rabbis of the Great Assembly came and set them in the liturgy, we couldn't even say these attributes. And you go on saying all of those that you said? It can be compared to a mortal king who has thousands and thousands of gold coins, but was praised for his silver. Wouldn't that be an insult to him? And that's what the tractate Brachot says. So this Talmudic passage states in a fairly concise and concrete way the inner paradox of prayer. We attempt to use finite words and limited concepts to pray to the infinite and unlimited God. God who is one beyond one, one before any concept of oneness, being beyond being, infinite and eternal. So the question is, how can we address God in prayer at all? And that's the question that the Gemara is dealing with. And the Gemara's answer is important. We really could not address God at all, were it not for that mode of address that's found in the Torah itself, the great book of Jewish scripture, meaning the mode of address that God himself gives us by which to address him, in the text that is his own self-expression, the Torah, by his prophet Moshe. That's the Talmudic point. To express this in a little bit more modern idiom, I think, to get the punchline here, this has been analyzed by a contemporary philosopher, actually, a phenomenologist, Immanuel Levinas, who was a student of Heidegger, and then turned into a significant critic of Heidegger's, Heidegger's phenomenology. And he's going to make a phenomenological statement of Levinas, and this should not be confused with a psychological statement. The statement on mystical prayer that I had that Alon graciously read yesterday stirred up some controversy. It was perceived that I was giving a psychological definition of mystical prayer. That might have been the result, but I was attempting to give a phenomenological definition of mystical prayer, meaning the intersection of consciousness and ontology. Consciousness and being. This is not psychology. This really is the ground of metaphysics, and that's what we're trying to work at here. This is what Levinas says. Catch this. He says, quote, "The idea of the infinite, an exceptional and unique idea, which according to Descartes is the thought addressed to God." The idea of the infinite is the thought addressed to God. Contrary to ideas according to which thinking progressively seizes the world, which are always on the level of the intentional object, the idea of the infinite would contain more than it is capable of containing, more than its capacity as a cogito, as an I think. The idea of the infinite would somehow think beyond what it thinks, in its relation to what should be its intentional correlate, it would be thrown off course, not resulting in anything or arriving at any end, and precisely not arriving at the finite, at a term or a close. The idea of the infinite is a thought released from consciousness. That's Levinas. The idea of the infinite itself, how do we contemplate this? That's his question. Okay, a thought released from consciousness. In Levinas' terms, that is prayer itself. A thought released from consciousness. He goes on, and it just makes it a little clearer. He says, according to Descartes, who identifies the idea of the perfect with the idea of God, the finite thought of man could never derive the infinite from itself. We could never reach any sense of God if we only relied on our own selves and our own experience. It would be necessary for God himself to put it in us. God himself must put the idea of the infinite in us. That's Descartes. But how could this idea of the infinite be held in a finite thought? The arrival, descent, or contraction of the infinite in a finite thought means, in any case, an event which describes the sense of what we designate as God. You can hear Kabbalistic overtones for those of you who have an ear to hear it in Levinas, who's quite aware of the Kabbalistic tradition. What it means is that to think the idea of the infinite takes a different mode of consciousness than normal intentionality, as phenomenologists understand it. It's an open intention. So the question is, how do we achieve an open intention? So Levinas here is tracing the idea of the infinite, which is the essence of prayer. Back to Descartes, he's a good phenomenologist, that's where you go back to. But he's also a very profound and well-informed Jewish thinker in his own right. Levinas is quite aware that the history of wrestling with this idea of the infinite predates Descartes by many centuries. So what I'd like to do together, and we'll do a bit of text work together, and a text that the sheet that's passed around, is to look at how this idea was explored by a particular, the important medieval Jewish thinker, who's the father of systematic Kabbalah, Yitzhak Sagi Nahor, Rav Isaac the Blind. Can you look at a paragraph of his? You have that along? They're going around, and also there's an original somewhere in my... Okay. Rav Isaac the Blind lived in Provence in the late 12th to early 13th century, and his commentary on Sefer Yetzirah is the first systematic text of the discipline that came to be known as Kabbalah. And this issue of the approach of the infinite through the finite is at the very heart of Kabbalah itself. So that's why I'm choosing to begin with this, and besides it addresses the issue of mystical prayer. I will in a moment give you a thumbnail sketch of the basic Kabbalistic principles we need, but I like to do this sort of as we go along rather than up front. So here's the text, and it's a doozy. Okay, it's really quite laconic, quite abstruse and very difficult text. He writes very much like his father, with Avraham ben David Paski, in a very elusive manner. So he quotes from the book Sefer Yetzirah, which we'll talk about in a little bit. I just want to read the text. Silence your heart from pondering the things hidden from thought, lest it become confused. For from that which one apprehends, one can recognize what one does not apprehend. And for this the dimensions were made. For language does not apprehend other than what comes from it. For man does not apprehend the dimension of speech and letters. Rather, its dimension is itself. And other than the letters, there is no dimension. All the awesome dimensions are given to comprehend. For every dimension is from a dimension that is above it. And they are given to Israel to comprehend. From the dimension that appears in the heart to comprehend unto Ein Sof, unto the infinite. For there is no way to pray other than by the finite things that a person receives and elevates in thought unto the infinite. Thus it says, again in the book Sefer Yetzirah, running forth and returning, it returns to its place, for the things in their swiftness ascend in their mystery and return to their place after their reception. Okay, that's clear, and let's see, a straightforward text. I want to go through this in a certain sense, piece by piece, and in this way bring out this question of how do we approach the infinite through the finite, which is really the subject that he's talking about. So first he says, silence your heart from pondering the things hidden from thought, lest it become confused. This is a theme that has a long tradition in Jewish thought, and can be found in other traditions as well, as we mentioned. It's referred to by Rabbi Bachi in Bakuda in the 11th century, by Maimonides in the 12th century, by Moshe Ibn Ezra in the 12th century. And a very characteristic text is from Rabbi Bachi Ibn Bakuda, philosopher, ethicist in a Neoplatonic and very mystical vein, in his Chovot HaLevavot, and it's you have this text also, let's see, yeah, on your sheets that were Xeroxed. It's the second chunk from the bottom. Okay, the Chovot HaLevavot 110. For when it comes to spiritual matters, when we attempt to clarify their existence, it is not prudent to examine too closely and inquire after their essence, lest we destroy our intellects. This is like someone who labors to grasp the sun in terms of its light, its rays, its illumination, and the negation of darkness from it. One will understand its existence and benefit from it and use its light and attain one's sought-for purpose. But one who labors to grasp the sun's circularity and focuses his eyes to gaze into the sun itself, his eyes shall be darkened and the light will be lost and shall not benefit from the sun. The same thing happens to us when we grasp the existence of God from his signs and we see his wisdom in them and his power in all his creatures. Then we shall know and understand him, and our intellects will be enlightened with his knowledge, and we shall grasp that which is within the power of our intellects to grasp. But if we trouble our intellects to grasp the essence of his glory and to imagine figuratively in our minds, our intellects will be stricken, will not even grasp that which we know, as happens to our eyes when we stare at the sun directly. See the distinction that Rabbi Bachi and Bakuda is making between indirect, oblique attempt at knowing God and a direct attempt at intuiting God with one's mind, which would destroy the mind just like looking into the sun. What this says, and it's important to appreciate this, this is a basic Kabbalistic point as well, the presence of God is hidden from human consciousness, but not hidden as being too weak or distant to be perceived. It's not hidden as being like below the radar of human consciousness or even on some other wavelength. That's not how it's hidden. The presence of God is hidden by its overwhelming presence, in the face of which consciousness has to filter it down and kind of stop down the aperture. God is, in a certain sense for us, too much present. So much so that our minds have to actually shut out the sense of his being. We do this automatically. This statement actually can trace it back to Aristotle. Aristotle says in De Anima, as bats' eyes are to the noonday sun, so are men's intellects to that which is most evident. Okay? What's hiding in plain sight is the hardest thing. See, and God is hiding in absolute overwhelming plain sight. Okay? So we don't know him because he's overwhelming our minds. And just like the sun would be overwhelming the eyes. And the idea is to find an oblique path of ascent to knowing and to intuiting God. And that's a basic Kabbalistic theme. So what Isaac the Blind is going on to do then is to describe how one does, in a safe way, kind of train your mind to see more and more of God, to open up the aperture, so to speak, and yet not be destroyed in the process. And that's the point of this paragraph. So he says, back to the paragraph itself at the top, from that which one apprehends, one can recognize what one does not apprehend. And for this, the dimensions were made. I'm using three dimensions. I'm translating the word midot. Midot, which means measures, attributes. It's another word for attributes, and it's what will be referred to technically as sfirot. Okay. It's probably a good time now to give a very brief thumbnail sketch of the major principles of Kabbalah, really quick. For those of you who are quite familiar with this, I hope it won't be going over too much material. I think we need Kabbalah itself, as I say, technically what we call Kabbalah developed in the late 12th, early 13th century. It's a combination of a number of factors of earlier Jewish mysticism, particularly a mystical work known as Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation or Formation, that appeared somewhere between the 3rd and the 6th century of the Common Era, which we call technically a Neo-Pythagorean work, which talks about the creation of the world in terms of 10 numbers and 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. That's how God created the world. These 10 numbers are called Sfirot.
It's an interesting word. I'm going to the history of philology. This word, Sfirot.
Taking this basis from Sefer Yetzirah, taking Neoplatonic philosophy in its Judaic form, which was just entering Provence in the late 12th century, and its theory of attributes, and including, in fact, Neoplatonic and Aristotelian theory of attributes, together with this notion of the Sfirot, the 10 numbers by which the world is created, and the 22 letters, the Kabbalists forged a system, basically which they understand as a Neoplatonic system, very similar, with many common features to the system that Jamal outlined before, that God in his own most essence is infinite and entirely unknowable, called Ein Sof. This corresponds to Plotinus's notion of God as the One, also unknown and infinite and eternal. Out of himself emanates, unfolds a series of hypostases, which are the means, we call them in philosophic terms, the attributes through which are the structures through which he creates the world. These are called the Sfirot. In Kabbalah, there are 10 of these Sfirot. Again, it's a Neo-Pythagorean system to some extent. And they emanate in a particular order. Just going to lay this out very quickly in an order, and there's a classic form in which this is graphically reproduced, and we'll move this a little later. That's what I'm doing. The first emanation is called Keter or Crown, also called Thought, pure thought. It's very similar to what Jamal talked about in terms of the first emanation for God being intellect. It's the same idea. From there emanates divine wisdom, divine understanding or discernment, from below these three first Sfirot hypotheses emanates a series of 7 called divine love or greatness. Find power or judgment. And the mediating principle called radiance or mercy. Two other principles, the principle of eternity or victory. Principle of divine majesty, which is a limiting principle, the principle of limiting the infinite. The notion of something called divine foundation, which is the generative and regenerative process in God. And finally, something called divine kingship or divine presence.
And of these emanations, actually two of these emanations are styled as feminine emanations, God in touch with his feminine side, which is, this is called Bina, understanding, and called Malchut, divine kingship or presence. Okay? These ten emanations actually have a certain pattern to them, that's why I drew it this way. They're evocative, roughly speaking, of the human body, by which the catalyst for expressing one of the deepest thoughts in Jewish tradition, the notion in the Torah, that man is created in the image of God. This is a statement made in the Torah about the creation of man. Man is in the image of God. What this means is the Kabbalists take this hyper-literally. That means that God, as he unfolds and reveals himself in this structure, and then goes from this structure to as the means for creation and for revelation in the world, God, as he reveals himself in a manner that corresponds to human being through and through, intellectually, emotionally, even physically in a certain sense. And the point of this is that since human beings is structured in the same pattern as divine being, that guarantees a certain level of intelligibility and can relate to and know God. This is the basic structure. We're going to use this structure now to explicate the text. Yes. The structure is in every creature. Every creature has some aspect of the structure in some kind of balance or preponderance. All of it, and with some kind of emphasis or balance or preponderance. What happens, let me just explain what these are. These essentially, what the Kabbalists are doing here, are taking philosophic attribute theory, as it was known in the 12th century, and organizing it in 10 archetypal categories. Okay? These are, in other words, all of the divine attributes of action, as the Kabbalists understood them, as the philosophers understood them, appear or organized under one or another of these rubrics of the spirit. Okay, so they really are similar. There are differences, but for all intents and purposes, it's very similar and it's useful enough for our purposes to think of this as divine attribute theory. The differences we don't need to dwell on at the moment, but we will in subsequent classes. Okay, does that answer what you wanted to know? It's through this structure that the world is created, that the world is patterned, and every creature in the world is patterned and has, in some sense, expresses the structure as well. Human being expresses the structure in its fullness and greatest radiance and balance. Okay. Now, the world just unfolds out of the infinite. Out of God as himself, out of the infinite. And this is a way of his creating the finite world, of, in a sense, channeling his power into creation, into the finite world, and into the governance of creation in revelation and in inspiration. And essentially, with Isaac the Blind was what we would call an epistemological optimist. He argued, basically, in the words of Heraclitus, that the path up and down is one and the same. Okay, the path down and the path up are the same. This optimism really is a shared trait among most Neoplatonists, because basically, as Jamal also mentioned, for the Neoplatonists, and the Kabbalists really endorse the Neoplatonic system, the program of human knowledge and of human spiritual development is to retrace the path of emanation, which issued in creation, and to trace that path back up to its source. And whether you understood that emanation is substantive emanation or formative emanation, which was a debate in the 12th century. So basically, to say, epistemology recapitulates ontology, according to the Kabbalists. No, the process of knowledge comes to recapitulate the process of the unfolding of being back to its source. So if Isaac the Blind describes the process of following the continuum of all being back to its source,
And that continuum, the fact that all being unfolds out of God himself, that this is the Kabbalistic idea of the creation of something from nothing, creation ex nihilo, is understood radically as creation out of God. God as the divine nothing, nothing not in a substantive sense, but in an epistemological sense, he's unknowable, therefore appears to any creaturely mind as nothing. But in truth, all creation unfolds out of God himself. And that's the guarantee for the adequacy of human knowledge of God in some sense, and that's the guarantee for the possibility of prayer.
Of prayer.
Of prayer, as we'll see. The possibility that our prayer connects to God in any way is based on, this is actually addressing your point before, the relationship of cosmology and prayer. This is it. I mean, the Kabbalists take this relationship very seriously. As we'll see, it's the continuum is the guarantee that prayer reaches its goal. Of all being. Of all being. Our structure, the structure of the entire world, as it unfolds out of God himself, we unfold out of God. And that abiding connection is the possibility of communication, it's the basis for the possibility of communication. Certainly. And that's important. Einstein said that the most mysterious thing about the world is that it's intelligible at all. He's right, right? I mean, that's the idea that man is in the image of God. That's the basis of the intelligibility of the world. Okay, if you can get that. A key feature of Rav Isaac the Blind's system does concern the limits of the direct reach of human thought, and particularly with relation to God as the infinite, but he does ultimately affirm the reliable accessibility of human thought through indirect transmission down the hierarchy of being through the sphero, and tracing human thought back up through the sphero. Now, this notion, just to put this into some perspective, this idea of cognitive continuity, that the human mind is connected to the divine mind, and just have to recognize that. This was not a generally accepted idea among all Jewish thinkers of the 12th or 13th century, even those who were somewhat Neoplatonic. Maimonides, with some exceptions, places emphasis on the separateness of God in the world, some important exceptions. Professor Yosef Dan has pointed out the distinction in the Hasidi Ashkenaz, another mystical group of the time, between their assumptions and the Kabbalists. For the Hasidi Ashkenaz, the sign of God was not that he has total continuity with the world, the fact that all of nature reflects the world, that's the Kabbalistic idea, but just the opposite. We know God when he erupts with strange, miraculous things in the otherwise pedestrian world. When something weird and strange happens, that's an act of God. Otherwise, it's just the world going on in its normal way. That's another mystical group at the same time. The Kabbalists held that all nature, through and through, reflects the revelation of God. In this, Rav Isaac the Blind, and I think those who are familiar with Neoplatonic thought can recognize this all the way back in all thinkers of all shades, all Platonists. Here, particularly, Rav Isaac the Blind follows in the footsteps of Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, the 11th century, Rav Avraham Bar Chiya, among the Jewish thinkers. This is a basic principle that is the key principle of Kabbalah to this very day. Let's move on to the next statement in that first text that we're looking at. This extraordinary statement, the third line for language, that third line at the end, says, "For language does not apprehend other than what comes from it. For man does not apprehend the dimension of speech and letters. Rather, its dimension is itself, and other than the letters, there is no dimension." What a strange statement. Jan, did you catch what's going on here? The not...
It's a limitation.
It's the limitation of speech itself, and not just the limits of speech to communicate, but there's a certain limit in speech of itself, beautiful, nicely said. Let me compare, for instance, this little modern philosophy, Jacques Derrida, it conjures up deconstructionism here, in a book of his called Monolingualism of the Other. Catch the resonance here. Derrida says, I'm quoting, I have only one language, but it is not mine. A language can only speak itself of itself. One cannot speak of a language except in that language, even if to place it outside itself. He continues, far from sealing off anything, this solipsism conditions the address to the other. It gives its word, rather gives the possibility of giving its word. And it gives the given word, this is Derrida, right? In the ideal of a threatening and threatened promise, monolingualism and tautology, the absolute impossibility